account. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how a simple herb can help overcome drug-resistant tuberculosis. Good research out of the University of Colorado. And then how drinking coffee, if you're wanting to become pregnant, will influence miscarriage. Big time. Ohio State University on that. Then we're going to look at beta-carotene and lycopene. That's what you get when you eat watermelon and tomatoes and red peppers and blood oranges. Can help prevent dermatitis. Also, from University of Miami, the older you get, the more intense the exercise should be. Absolutely opposite what we have been believing for 100 years. So we have to really get older adults engaged in strenuous exercise to be more mentally nimble, have better memory function, and process information more speedily than they do their sedentary peers. We'll talk about that. Also today, I'm going to go through a very quick succession of many different articles. I won't go into the journals, but they're all peer review. I just want to give you a caption to think about, because your brain can process it. It'll be one of those, okay, I didn't know that. That gives me something to think about. For example, I'll talk about how heart bypass surgery increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Now, that's from the published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, done at Boston University School of Medicine. Well, the details of it I won't give you, but it's just something to think about in case you're one of those people who would have thought nothing of having bypass surgery because you thought there were no other options. A, there are, and B, there's a consequence. So it's just to let you know, before you do something, do your homework. Then the second part of our program today, I'm setting aside 35 minutes for our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. This will be Professor Andrew Harvey, quite simply one of the most brilliant people on the planet. And he's going to talk about why are we unable to join together on anything that's important to stop abuse, to stop corruption, to make a difference. Well, because we're not doing it in our own lives. And he will explore that. That will be a really in-depth conversation. Also, not today, I won't have time, but coming up next week, I'm going to have people who can make a difference, very wise men and women, with short 3 to 5 minute insights. Now, these are very profound thinkers. And my view is that the media is dumbing people down. The information is more superficial. It is not functional information, meaning you can't really use it for anything. And we need the antidote. And the antidote is deeper thinking on the human condition. So I'll be sharing that with you starting next week in these segments on a regular basis. And also a commentary today, The Graveyard of Elites from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. Let's begin. First off, we want to be able to help those who have a drug-resistant tuberculosis because they die. New research indicates that curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. Now, we've talked about this many times. It's the active ingredient in turmeric. And turmeric, T-U-R, meric, M-E-R-I-C, is best known as one of the main ingredients in curry, and it helps fight drug-resistant tuberculosis. And turmeric has been used to treat many health conditions. It's anti-inflammatory, it's an antioxidant, has anti-cancer properties, thousands of studies on it, and we're seeing a resurgence of the drug-resistant tuberculosis. So this was shown to actually help. So keep that in mind, especially if you're traveling to Southeast Asia or Africa. And if for any reason you should come down with it, make sure that you have curcumin capsules that you take with you in your emergency medicine kit. A lot of people plan their pregnancies, which is good. But you should spend at least 2 years detoxifying, having natural chelation therapy to get the heavy metals out, lead, mercury, cadmium, of rebalancing your cells' energy, and also putting positive epigenetic messages into your DNA. All that will become your developing fetus. The one thing you should not have is caffeine. Why? According to High State University, quote, a woman is more likely to miscarry if she and her partner drink more than 2 caffeinated beverages a day. Now, when you think of how many pregnancies end up in miscarriage, it's almost a third. So this is just one way. If you want a new life in this world, you're putting the opportunity to have it by cleansing, taking your time, and detoxifying. From Hiroshima University, oral administration of B-carotene and lycopene prevents atopic dermatitis. This was published in the Journal of Dermatology. Why is this important? Because we have millions of people with dermatitis problems. And more often than not, I find that they have an imbalance in the bad fats, the trans fats, French fries, potato chips, a lot of the cooking oils, really bad fats. And they have too much sugars, and almost all processed sugars, including the soft drink sugars, the high fructose corn syrup, that can lead to dermatitis. By having more of beta-carotene, there's your carrots, celeries, your vegetables, and lycopene, your red fruits and vegetables, like red peppers, watermelon, beets, plums, blood oranges, and those are the ones that give you the greatest amount of lycopene in tomatoes. You can help prevent that. University of Miami, they're talking about why the older you get, the more intense should be your exercise. Well, we were always told the older you get, take it easy, take it easy. We were giving the wrong information for the last 100 years. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, and that's why we have to keep pushing ourselves the older we get. The latest research is the most recent study to underscore the importance of intensive exercise to maintain health and aging. In addition to keeping diabetes and heart disease and osteoporosis at bay or in check, there's just hundreds of studies suggesting a good workout is powerful medicine for the aging brain, preventing and treating depression, and shoring up cognitive function. So make sure that you get your mom, dad, grandparents, anyone, or yourself if you're older, get into the older exercising. And it reminds me of a gentleman who, when I met him, he was around 90, and he was checking out. His wife had died. He no longer felt any joy in living. And I had a long conversation with him, and what we got him to do is come down to Central Park and start in our power walking. And he did. And he went on to live many more years in vital health. And he reconnected with things that gave him joy. But it was the exercise that was one of the biggest things. I remember once we had gone around the park 6 miles, and I was having a workout discussion with the athletes, as I frequently do. And about 20 minutes later, here he comes. And everyone applauded him. There must have been about 100 of us, so we made a line as he came walking in. Everybody was cheering him. And this big smile came on his face, and he came over to me. He says, I haven't done any kind of exercise in the longest period of time, decades. I didn't know how much fun it was and how good I feel. Every day that I exercise, I feel so much better the whole day. I get a good night's sleep before I didn't. My appetite is better. Before it wasn't. I'm not depressed anymore. Before I was. So when I say intense exercise, the older you get, the better it is. It can make a big difference. And finally, blueberry leaf infusion ameliorates insulin resistance. And this is from the University of Miyazaki in Japan. And what they found was that taking the blueberry leaf and make it into an infusion, which is a liquid that you can use, made an enormous difference in helping maintain the insulin level in the body. So if you're a pre-diabetic or diabetic, that would make a tremendous difference for you. So that's the latest on that. Now we're going to go through some quick points, and I'm really going to give you mainly the headlines, but it's to, in your memory, you're going to be able to do some additional research on this. First up, caffeine intake is tied to teens' blood pressure. The amount of caffeine consumed by teenagers is directly related to their daytime blood pressure, and this effect is especially pronounced among African Americans. This is in Reuters, which simply means the more caffeine kids take in, the higher their blood pressure, and blood pressure is killing a lot of African Americans and now teens. Mobile phone use, that's your cell phone, is linked with tumors. And this is from the Telegraph, and it says, quote, long-term use of mobile phones are significantly more likely to develop a certain type of brain tumor on the side of the head where they hold their handsets. And this was a large study, found that those who had regularly used mobile phones for more than 10 years were 40%, that's 40% more likely to develop nervous system tumors called gliomas near to where they hold their headsets. Well, then use only the cordlet. Use a cord, so you put it on speaker or you have it where you have the earplugs, but the phone is kept 4 or 5 feet away from your body. Strokes among mid-age women triple, from Marilyn Marchioni from AP. Quote, strokes have tripled in recent years among middle-aged women in the United States, and an alarming trend doctors blame on obesity epidemic. And we're talking about women 35 to 55 years of age. I would say it's more than obesity. I would say it's stress, depression, and eating comfort foods or drinking. All of those together are pro-inflammatory, and that increases the risk of stroke. Lights at night are linked to breast cancer. This is from Life Extension Bulletin, quote, women who live in neighborhoods with large amounts of nighttime illumination are more likely to get breast cancer than those who live in areas where nocturnal darkness prevails. This was a major study. I suggest a night pad, a comfortable, you can get different materials, but a cotton pad you put over your eyes like a little mask, and it blocks out all the light. That could help. Prozac used by 40 million people does not work, say scientists. And this is from Sarah Bosley of The Guardian. Analysis of unseen trials and other data concludes it's no better than a placebo. Prozac, the best-selling antidepressant taken by 40 million people, does not work, nor do similar drugs in the same class, according to a major peer-reviewed study. The study examined all available data on the drugs, including results from clinical trials that the manufacturers chose not to publish. They hid it. So the things that didn't work, they hid. And it found out you could take a sugar pill and get the same results. Remember that if you're on Prozac, a sugar pill is equally good without the side effects, including suicidal ideation. Survey finds 80% of doctors witness mistakes. From Maggie Fox from Reuters, 80% of U.S. doctors and half of nurses surveyed said they had seen colleagues make mistakes, but only 10% ever spoke up. Wow. Talking about covering for your colleagues, well, what if that mistake led to someone's disability, disfigurement, or death? Still, protecting the colleagues or themselves is more important than protecting the patient. Dirty teeth can kill you. This is Reuters. Quote, germs found in dental plaque can make their way into the lungs and cause potentially fatal pneumonia in elderly nursing home patients. Well, that's true. But you don't have to be in a nursing home. Dirty gums with germs in your mouth at any age can also lead to the heart, especially cytomegalovirus. And that's why cleaning the teeth 2 to 3 times a day and flossing and using a mouth cleanser are what you should be doing. Pfizer pays tens of millions of dollars for deaths of Nigerian children in drug trial experiments. David Gutras, National News. Quote, pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has agreed to pay $75 million to settle a class action lawsuit filed against it by Nigerian parents who claim the company caused harm to their children by using them as guinea pigs in a non-consensual, unlicensed drug trial. Takeaway message here is, what if this were hundreds or thousands of American children from affluent neighborhoods going to private schools who were put into a drug experimental trial? What do you think the results would have been? But as long as it's a poor kid of color in a country with no capacity to fight back, then it continues. It tells us a lot about the people working at Pfizer in all levels. It talks about their management, their lawyers. It talks about the type of capitalism, mercenary capitalism, that preys on those who are defenseless. And not a thing will happen to their reputation because of this. And finally, too much red meat boosts rheumatoid arthritis risk. From Health Day News, study published in Arthritis and Rheumatism. If you like your hamburgers, steak, and other red meat, you might be at increased risk of rheumatoid arthritis. University of Manchester studied people newly diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis in at least two major joints and 176 control subjects without it. The study found that people who eat a lot of red meat have twice the risk of rheumatoid arthritis as those who eat less meat. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. I'm Gary Nall. In just about 10 minutes, we'll go to our guest. But first, many of you I know are frustrated by the conditions that are not changing in the United States. And we'll deal with this in more intimate detail with my guest. But the power elites, and we know who they are, blinded by hubris, intoxicated by absolute power, unable to set limits on their exploitation of the underclass, propelled to expand empire beyond its capacity to sustain itself, addicted to hedonism, spectacle, and wealth, surrounded by half-witted courtiers, Alan Greenspan, Thomas Friedman, David Brooks, and others, who tell them what they want to hear. And we end up with a false sense of security because their ability to employ massive state violence are the last to know their privileged world is imploding. This is according to Chris Hedges. Chris believes that the carnival of the presidential election, I think most of you would agree, is a public display of the deep morbidity and artifice that have gripped American society. Political discourse has been reduced by design to trite patriotic and religious cliches, sentimentality and sanctimonious peons to the American character. We have made into a religion the military. And we end up with adolescent taunts instead of real dialogue and communication. All this has left reality behind. Politicians are little more than brands. They sell skillfully manufactured personalities. These artificial personalities are used to humanize corporate oppression. They cannot and do not intend to end the futile and ceaseless wars, to dismantle the security and surveillance state, to halt the fossil fuel industry's ecocide, to curb the predatory clash of bankers and international financiers, to lift Americans out of poverty or restore democracy. None of that is going to happen. Our constitutional democracy is dead. It does not work, or rather it does not work for us. No politician or elected official can alter anything of substance. Throughout the administrations of George Bush and Barack Obama, there have been complete continuity on nearly every issue. Indeed, if Obama has a legacy, is that he has made things incrementally worse. He has accelerated the assault on civil liberties, expanded the imperial wars, including empowering the government to order the assassination of American citizens and open up new drilling sites on public lands as if he were Sarah Palin. He has failed to rein in Wall Street, which is busy orchestrating another global financial meltdown, and turned our healthcare system over to rapacious corporations. He has made war on immigrants and overseen economic collapse among the poor, especially African Americans. He appears to be powerless to shut down our torture center in Guantanamo, a potent recruiting tool for jihadists, or place any new justice on the Supreme Court. His successor will be as impotent. Obama, now a charter member of the ruling elite, will become rich, as did the Clintons when he leaves office. The moneyed elites will pay for his two presidential libraries, grotesque vanity projects. They will put him on boards and lavish him with astronomical speaking fees. But as a Democratic leader, he has proven to be as pathetic as his predecessor. Bernie Sanders, who at least acknowledges our economic reality and refuses to accept corporate money for his presidential campaign, plays the role of the Democratic Party's court jester. No doubt, to remain a member of the court, he will not condemn the perfidy and collaboration with corporate power that define Obama, Hillary, and Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party. They are all corrupt. He accepts that criticism of empire is taboo. He continues even as the party elites rig the primaries against him to make the mockery of Democratic participation, to hold up the Democrats as a tool for change. They are not. The Democrats are completely, totally, and committed to their own agenda, not to benefit us. He will soon be urging his supporters to vote for Hillary Clinton, actively working as an impediment to political mobilization and an advocate for political lethargy. Sanders, whose promise of a political revolution is as hollow as a competing campaign slogan, will be rewarded for his duplicity. He will be allowed to keep his seniority in the Democratic caucus. The party will not mount a campaign against him. The whole election cycle is a carnival act, full of sound and fury and significant for nothing. It caters to the most venal instincts of the public. It is an example of the deep cynicism among elites who, like all other con artists, privately mock us for our gullibility and naivety. We are treated like malleable children, morally vain and irredeemably sentimental. The world of junk politics is theirs to control. None of those elected to the White House, Congress, or state houses have the power, and they know it, to challenge the corporate disempowering of the country. The popular rage and frustration that have been rising against the established power elites during this election campaign will mount further as Americans, especially with a new president in the White House, realize that their voice and their vote are meaningless. The white nativists and bigots who flock to Donald Trump, along with those who sell out the most basic liberal tenet to support Hillary Clinton, are about to get taught a harsh lesson about the nature of our system of inverted totalitarianism. Let us now go over and say hello to Luann Panessi, who is standing by. Hi, Luann. Do we have Luann?
Hello. There? Yes, I'm right here. Thank you so much, Gary. Yes, I'm here. And okay. In spite of all this, Gary, there is hope, especially when you have your retreats. It helps people deal with all the things that are going on by first and foremost dealing with themselves. So I am very excited to announce that we have a couple of openings left. I'm interviewing people, really nice people, Gary, from your audience. And a lot of, we have some people that are newcomers, brand new. We have people that have come to other retreats that are looking forward to coming back again. So there's the only criteria we really have that you need to be a nice person. So we just have nice people coming down. So I don't know if you wanted to go into this anymore, but I wanted to give out my number if people still want to call.
Sure, but let me share something with you. This is from the University of California, Santa Barbara. A study says people are capable of multiple simultaneous life changes. I'll quote this. Let's say you've decided to make some change in your life. You're out of shape, your mind wanders, your self-esteem is wavering, and you have no idea what you just read. So you decide to focus on one thing, losing weight maybe, and tackle the issue, other issues later. You don't want to take on too much at once, right? A new paper by researchers at the University of California, however, suggests you're selling yourself short. Quote, pushing the limits, cognitive, affective, and neural plasticity revealed by intensive multifaceted intervention is the title of an article. What it shows in lay language is we are capable of multiple changings all at the same time. We can change our work habits, our personal habits, our relationship habits. We can improve our perception of the world. We can change our perception of the world. We can no longer feel like a victim. We can no longer feel that circumstances have overtaken us and go into a depression for what we cannot handle. We can surrender anger and rage from anger and depression that follows rage and anger and become optimistic. As much as I will call out the tortured political system and the economic system, I'm also one who believes in the sanctity of life, and I believe in the sanctity of the spirit. Therefore, for those who are willing to wake up, to be focused, there is hope. There are emerging new economies. There's emerging new environmental movement. There's emerging new shared living communities. There are emerging whole new renewable energy industries. There are people who are starting over, and we're not talking about a few thousand or 100,000. We're talking about multiple millions. So on the one hand, I see no hope whatsoever for the average American who's not willing to change. I see an enormous amount of hope for those who are. And the whole purpose of the retreat is to inspire people with some of the best critical thinking, lectures, discussions, and counseling, workshops, hands-on, close to nature, beautiful environment up near the Ozarks, in the mountains, where you're close to nature, you're able to spend quality time, no cell phones are allowed. We focus on silence, we focus on meditation, we focus upon learning lessons that we have not yet been exposed to, or if we have, we didn't pay attention to allow the true and authentic self to emerge. That's the whole purpose. Negative, hostile, bitter, sarcastic people do not apply. You'll be sent home. Positive people, you're welcome to be there. So if you want to change your life, this is the only reason you should come. Don't come because you want to relax, de-stress, detoxify. You can do that in 100 other places. This is the place people come to change their life. It's that simple. All right? And those who have, they've changed their lives. I've seen more people change their life for the better than any other thing they could do because they've got quality time to do it. That's it. Give your number out, please.
Yes, it's 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. I interview everyone to make sure this is, in fact, the right venue for you to attend. And from some of the testimonials we've had, Gary, that came straight from the heart, people truly have life-changing experiences.
That's what it's about. So, thank you, Luann. Now we're going to take a break and come back with one of the greatest minds on the planet addressing the very issues we've just now been discussing. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We are looking at major change that is needed. The question is, do we have the spiritual awareness to become that change individually and collectively? And why are we unable to reach a collective unity to confront the challenges in our personal lives, the nation, and the planet? My guest today is Andrew Harvey. Andrew is an internationally renowned religious scholar, writer, teacher, and author of over 30 books. He is the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our social and global crisis and to commit themselves to peace and sustainability. Andrew was born in India and studied and taught at Oxford University, where he was the university's youngest fellow at the age of 21, teaching Shakespeare and French literature. He is perhaps best known for having explored all the different religions in depth and has reinterpreted them in a passionate manner that preserves their meaning and significance for our own time. In 1993, BBC featured him in a documentary, The Making of a Modern Mystic. Andrew has received many awards for his writings, including the Benjamin Franklin Award. Among his many books are The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, which won the Nautilus Silver Award for Social Change, and more recently, Play Life More Beautifully, Conversations with Seymour, which recounts his friendships with a renowned American pianist and composer, Seymour Bernstein. Andrew's website is andrewharvey.net. Nice to have you with us today, Andrew.
Great to be with you, Gary, as always.
We're currently in a new electoral campaign season, and although statistics show the American population is more mobilized to participate in this election, the U.S. continues to rank among the apathetic of the world towards politics.
Yes.
The rulers of the economic and constructive social change we challenge. In 2012, the U.S. ranked 120th among 169 nations between the Dominican Republic and Benin in apathy towards voter turnout. And I recall that Aristotle wrote, "Tolerance and apathy are the last virtues of a dying society." And as a population, we're socially similar to rodents fed junk food in a laboratory. We tolerate repressive environments. We willfully allow ourselves to be passively confined in a maze with no interest in escape or self-preservation. Our collective resolve is to truly confront the threats of climate change. And it's just one example of the evidence that there's an increase in climate change denialism. There is apathy among those people who don't deny it, but simply don't believe that their change makes any difference. More than ever before, we're clogging the ocean with plastic. We're not even getting paper at the store instead of plastic. We continue to watch reality television. We continue to watch our neighbor across the street, who we've known for 10, 20, 30 years, as the constables come to say, "You've got 20 minutes to get out of your house." Mm. And there were 8 million of these foreclosures, yet not one demonstration by a community to say no more. If you foreclose on our homes, we're going to take our money out of your banks. We're going to stop going into your box stores. We're going to stop playing your music, watching your television, listening to your radio, voting in your elections. We're going to boycott you economically, and that's your only life, is your economic standard.
Right.
And we will repel. But we're not saying that.
No.
And as a result, we are angry, and we know anger prematurely ages us. We're stressed. We know stress creates cortisol and creates people from being in the moment in spiritual. Instead, they're epigenetically reacting to everything. And yet, we're then looking at, is it going to be Trump or Hillary Clinton? Not even considering Jill Stein, who would be a far better candidate. In other countries, we see a million plus turning out to protest. In fact, are you aware that last week 3 million people took the streets of Brazil to
absolutely to get rid
challenge.
Of Dilma Rousseff? Yes,
that's correct. And yet, not a word in the American media at one of the largest spontaneous protests
in history
of the world. And it was not organized; it was spontaneous, and yet not a word. In Quebec, a million angry students demonstrated when the Harper government increased tuition fees. In the United States, nothing. We don't see these kind of numbers in the United States, not even at Trump and Sanders rallies. So I'd like you to begin by addressing the collective apathy we witness across America. And why do we not engage in any of the movements that could take us to another level of change? And what does it say about the American population when they're willing to be subservient political slaves to a system that supports a tiny minority of wealthy elite and power brokers, and they're not a part of it? The forum is yours.
Well, my God, Gary, you've sketched it in such a clear and ferocious way. What I would like to say is that this apathy that you describe is to my mind, the most devastating thing about America. I've lived now in America for 30 years, and I poured myself out with all the other teachers trying to arouse the American people to see the tragedy and horror of what we are living and to react to it. And it has been consistently heartbreaking to confront the complete lack of interest in doing anything about anything. I think there are many, many reasons for this apathy. The most important one, I believe, is that the corporations want us apathetic. They want us individualist, atomized, apathetic, so that we can be willing robots in the death machine. The second reason is that what I see is that there's a huge amount of fake spirituality being sold by the corporations that say fundamentally, don't look at the dark, don't look at misery and torment and injustice. That's negative. Concentrate on the light and all will be fine and you'll be able to manifest mansions in Malibu and Cuban houseboys or whatever else you want. This is an orgy of narcissism masquerading as authentic spirituality, and it's polluted the minds of millions. But there's a deeper reason, and I don't know how to express this, but what I believe is that America is in a massive psychic depression, and this depression comes from never having confronted the fundamental shadows of its history, never having confronted really the horror of the genocide in the Native Americans, never having confronted the horror, the real horror of all those centuries of slavery, never having confronted the genocide of the animals, and being completely incapable of confronting the shadow of its imperial ambition. When you suppress such deep shadows, they erupt in you secretly and collapse your inner world. And this is what I think we're looking at. We're looking at a culture that is collapsed inwardly through its inability to confront what has actually shaped its power. And behind that collapse, behind that depression, is, I'm convinced, and this is something that I find really alarming, a kind of death wish. Apathy isn't only a freezing of the heart. It's a sign that the psyche is terribly, terribly sick. And I think what the American psyche is sick with is a profound death wish, an anomie, a deep hatred of life, a deep sadness at the inadequacy of the life of the American dream, and a deep depression which is born out of its inability to deal with what has actually happened. And this is a very savage and very dangerous cocktail, and it does not presage well. And it makes the American people horribly vulnerable to mad and potentially dangerous fascist demagogues like Trump. So that would be my two cents.
All right. Do you feel it's possible for an entire culture to develop a shared form of mental disturbance, a socially shared pathology?
Of course it is. We've seen it. We saw it in Nazi Germany. We've seen it in repeated moments in history when a whole population is taken over by very dark forces, dark psychic forces, and enacts the most terrible brutalities in perfect confidence. And America could easily become one of those countries. In fact, what we're looking at, I think, potentially, is the most powerful fascist state the world's ever seen being installed here. Its preparation is already with us. We've got massive surveillance. The economy is in the hands of a very few people. Politics is almost totally bought out by lobbyists. People are in an apathetic and angry state, a weird mixture of apathy and angry. This is the perfect cocktail for a demagogue to pretend all kinds of fictions and then lead the poor people into enacting all kinds of barbarity. And look what Trump is actually proposing: building a wall to keep out Mexicans and making them pay for it, having people beaten up at his rallies who dare to question him, and it goes on and on.
we might call this empathy deficit disorder. Actually, several studies reveal that the loss of empathy is increasing among the younger generation, even though you would expect it to decline based upon the lack of interconnectivity between the older and younger generations. And yet, a few years back, a University of Michigan study found that today's college students are 40% less empathetic than in 1979. How does that loss of empathy contribute to our social ills, adding on to what you just mentioned?
Well, if you add to the fundamental disconnection of our technological society from nature and the tragic dissociation from the sacred that has been characteristic of Western civilization for four centuries, if you add to that this kind of deterioration of empathy, you have the perfect setting for the end of a civilization and potentially the world. I was teaching in Iowa, and I had the great good fortune of having a very brilliant, very sensitive 16-year-old in my class. And I asked him, "Tell me about your generation. Do they care? Are they really concerned?" He said, "I wish I could say that they were, but I want to give you an example of how scared I am by them." He said, "Last week we were shown newsreels of the Holocaust, and most of the people in the room were either chattering or on their iPads or actually laughing." And I said, "Laughing? Laughing as they see the bodies being..." "Yes, laughing. For them, it was comic. And I couldn't even begin to get my head around it. It really disturbed me. It kept me up all night." Can you imagine being in a room filled with privileged teenagers on their iPads watching the most appalling horrors that humanity has ever inflicted on itself and laughing? That's more than lack of empathy. There's something terrifyingly dark about that. When you think of this generation, it's had three generations of systematic destruction of the heart and mind by a Hollywood addicted to violence. So that must have played a huge part. But to laugh at the Holocaust, what kind of world are these kids in, and what kind of world will they create? I have no idea.
Let's focus on that for a moment, because when you and I were growing up, our parents came from the greatest generation. They had suffered privations from the early 1930s through the end of the World War II. That's about 16 years. There was no Social Security. There was no Medicaid, Medicare. There were no food banks. It was just your home, your family, and the churches that supported you during rough times. And yet, that also is where the concept of character in the face of adversity strengthens you. And character is an awareness that every thought you have, every deed you engage in, has an outcome. And that generation actually was capable, when we were born, of telling us as young children in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, turn around and look at what has happened and you'll see where you're at today. But unless you turn around and understand the consequences of your choices and other people's choices, you'll never appreciate what it means to reach a goal. You'll just reach a goal without any idea that, well, your goal could be a heart attack from all the soft drinks you drank and all the hamburgers and hot dogs. The goal could be bankruptcy. The goal could be a heroin addiction, cocaine. The goal could be greed, working nonstop. So if you want to see the value of your choices, look ahead and extrapolate what is the likely outcome unless I change. Today's youth do not look ahead except for rare exceptions. That's mainly because the parents or others who had input. Instead, each day, like a leaf in the wind, they float. And wherever they land, they're supposed to be immediately embraced, appreciated. You're not to say anything or do anything that will make them feel uncomfortable. In fact,
the other thing that's so alarming. I asked him, I actually had lunch with him. He was such an exceptionally intelligent person and quite stricken by the world and stricken by his own generation. And he said, "You know, one of the most dangerous things is the way in which everybody's always treated as supremely special, whatever they do, and talked about as if they were a mixture of Leonardo da Vinci and Shakespeare, whether they can actually spell. And this mad, mad, endless message that's been given the kids that they're already amazing, already divine, or don't have to do anything, don't have to have character, don't have to have a conscience, don't have to build a life, don't have to learn the rigor of a real discipline. This is devastating their psyches and producing entitled, lost monsters.
Let me give you an example of how that actually works. And I saw this firsthand when I interviewed a family. This was a family that both parents at one point had been upper middle class. They were both engineers for NASA over Cape Canaveral and the west east coast of Florida and near Titusville. And they were in a park. Now, there were two parks. One was woods, where you had thousands of homeless vets, no water, no electricity, no car, no food. They would go to a place called the Daily Bread each day, which many had to walk for 4 to 5 miles to get to, have a meal that neither the state, city, or county supported, and then walk back. If they went for a job, there were no jobs the moment you said you were a vet. No one wanted to hire you, even though they were first in line in the morning. And, excuse me, in any case, there was another park. That other park was totally different. It was filled with new model cars, including vans and SUVs, and there were probably 50 to 60 of them. Mm. And the first one I came to was an Escalade, and as I walked around with my camera guy, there was four people, a husband, wife, and two teenage daughters, and they were cooking some noodle soup on the radiator. And I told him I was doing a documentary on poverty in America. And first, they didn't want to talk to me. But then when I interviewed some other people and came back, they said, okay. And at one time, they had a home worth almost $500,000. They had several $100,000 in the bank. They had no debt. And they were both making over $150,000 a year. So they had a great income. I said, well, how'd you get to be homeless?
God.
And the husband said, because I didn't realize the consequences of trying to disconnect from what I should have abandoned very quickly. And I said, what's that? He said, I wanted to maintain our standard of living and the appearance that we were okay for the girl's sake. Mm. And I talked with the girls. I said, did you know your parents were unemployed? Yes. Did you know that they didn't have money coming in? Only they had what they had saved? Yes. Did you stop any of your habits? They said, well, we couldn't. When you're in our group, you have to go to the mall. You have to buy stuff you don't need. If you've got 15 pairs of sneakers, you have to buy another pair. When there's some kind of benefit, you have to show up. Your parents have to write a check and smile like, you know, everything's fine. Because in our group, when one of our friends' family got unemployed, everyone, you know, rejected them.
I said, madness, isn't it?
But this is what they were telling me. As a result, for 2.5 years, they kept up this facade.
Oh, God.
And all the while, instead of finding a job, they felt that this was going to pass. They're too well educated. They have too much experience. Surely they'll get another job. And by the time they realized that there were thousands of other people in their area with equal background and experience looking for any job, and the jobs they had were gone forever, they had run through all of their money. They couldn't pay their mortgage on their house, so they lost their house. They lost everything. And now she was cleaning houses when she could find that work during the daytime, and he was working in a store or at a car wash drying cars when it comes out and you see the guys rub the towels around the car.
Yeah, God.
And I said, well, what did it do? And the daughter said, well, until we actually had to move out of our house, no one knew. But once we moved out of our house, within 24 hours, no one would return our cell phones calls. Nobody wanted anything to do with us. And I said, but why would you want to be associated with people who have no value? That brings me to this. And then I'd like for you to give us your insight.
Terrible story. God.
This is a saying from Doninsky. Allowing people inside your life is a beautiful thing. Letting go of people who drain your spirit is another beautiful thing you can do for your life.
Absolutely.
The key to being happy is knowing you have the power to choose what to accept and what to let go of. And we have a phenomena of Americans who didn't want to let go of their standard of living, didn't want to let go of their comforts, didn't want to let go of their multiple material possessions, didn't want to stop purchasing more with money they didn't have. And as a result, they wanted everything, including expecting to show up and be accepted, starting off at a job and immediately wanting to go to the top because, well, I'm here 3 weeks. Can I get a better position? And don't tell me to come in at 9 and leave at 5. I'll come in, you know, when I get up and I'll work on my personal emails and everything else, my Twitter, and I'll do some porn. But at some point in the day, I may do some work for you. But don't say anything because just like Emory University, they're now offering kids at Emory University today, as we speak, they're offering them free psychological counseling for the trauma that someone suggested Donald Trump may be the president. And it caused such trauma in them, and it so affected their emotions, they now need psychological counseling.
God.
This is what we become.
Absolutely.
Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, when you were describing the family that you met, and obviously both of our hearts go out to their madness and the suffering that they put themselves into, what you're really talking about is the disease of the whole culture. After all, what is America doing? It's strip mining the world. It's indulging an orgy of completely unsustainable progress. It refuses to cope with any of the backlash from any of its policies, and it's potentially going to elect this mad Republican carnival barker, all of which shows that it's completely addicted to this fake, crazy dream that is now not only terrorizing millions all over the world, but driving the environment into extinction. This is a madness that I don't think the world has ever seen, and America is the center and the fomenter of that madness. And the problem with America, for me, is that there is nobody willing to speak to Americans who has a real position of power. Whenever a politician, even Obama, gets up and talks to Americans, he has to say all kinds of wonderful things about American history, about manifest destiny, about rah, rah, rah. You can never hear on the airwaves someone with the grit and rigor, say, of a Churchill, will just get up and say, this is a totally unacceptable situation. We have to go through a major spiritual revolution. We've got to see that we are strip mining the world and creating total chaos for the future. And we've got to bring a true regime of justice and equality in whatever Wall Street says and however the billionaires scream. You wouldn't last a day in politics because nobody wants to hear the truth and nobody can bear it. Nobody wants to give up any of the gewgaws and games that the dream proposes. And that's why this culture, and short of multiple miracles, is headed straight towards extinction. I'm sorry to be so grim, but
I'd rather you be honest and grim, so at least we see what we're faced with. You can't change a problem that you're not willing to acknowledge.
No, there's that wonderful Jewish saying, you know, saying you're sick is one half of the cure, but nobody will tell the American people how sick they are. Nobody will tell the American people how tragic the situation we're in is. Nobody will tell the American people that they have to make sacrifices, that the dream is a nightmare. Nobody will do this because the way in which the corporate speak has been set up is a bizarre mixture of crazy Darwinian get it while you can with fake fascist cheerfulness. It's a horrible cocktail, and it makes real talk and real radical critique and real sacrifice and real spirituality almost impossible.
How can increasing empathy help us to confront the threats of global warming and climate change, and how would we act more differently towards the environment and the planet if we were more empathetic, and how might we act differently if we had more enlightened view and understanding about the idea of community?
Well, my God, it would change everything. I think the word environment is a disgusting word. We aren't the environment isn't out there. It doesn't have this kind of Latin ring to it. Nature, we're in nature, we're part of nature, and our tragedy is that our history has dissociated us from nature and given us a fantasy of being able to dominate nature, which has resulted in a tremendous loneliness of soul and a horrible and final dissociation. The only healing for that, Gary, that I know, is to go into profound meditation and prayer, go on deep shamanic journeys so that you can rebuild the ancient oneness that humanity did have in its first days with nature. If you can get even a glimpse of what it is to feel this oneness, oneness with other beings, human beings, animals, with the trees, and if you're graced to have a real realization of the staggering interdependent oneness of the universe, that glory beyond glory that is the truth of reality, that changes everything, because from that position all you long for is harmony and balance and justice and living a life that allows you to express the values of harmony, balance, justice and compassion. And that transforms your own experience, and it transforms the kinds of friendship you have, and it thrills you with the truth of community, because you understand that a community reflects that interdependence potentially, and when you truly feel others who also share that vision supporting and encouraging you, then together you can rise to say no to this mad evil and darkness that is threatening the whole of human life, and yes to the difficult but possible task, still possible I believe, of reconstructing our society to reflect real values instead of crazy demented ones.
You once wrote that we cannot solve our problems with our shadow. Can you go into this more depth, and what would be the collective shadow of the nation today that people are trying to work within in order to reform it? And then, wow, well, I believe that that will fail.
I think the collective shadow of America is its insane belief that it is the most unique culture in the world, specially selected by God, uniquely blessed. All of this is a terrible fantasy, especially when you look at American history and the, as I've said, the genocides that it's been built on. I've just finished reading this extraordinary book by Ta-Nehisi Coates called Between the World and Me, and he analyzes the American shadow, and he calls Americans dreamers, dreamers of the American dream, this dream that is meant to guarantee American power, guarantee endless growth, guarantee gold just falling into the laps of everyone who works, all of that madness. You cannot solve the catastrophe of this exploding world crisis from within the very heartset and mindset that has created it and continues to keep it going.
When you use the term unity, there needs to be a unifying thread that people share in common and can interconnect with them. There needs to be a value or a yes. set of values or an ideal that the majority of people can rally around in unison. And these probably have to be spiritual values, not religious per se.
No.
But more or less universal in,
yes.
in terms of fueling a new vibrant activism that can lead to massive demonstrations and organize actions.
Yes.
It would be so easy, Harvey, to undermine and take away the power of all these rich people, simply stop buying what they profit from.
That would be one way. But there again, you told the story. If you stop buying what they profit from, if you stop playing your role in this absurd American dream melodrama, you become marginalized. And I think people are terrified of being marginalized. People are terrified of being alone. They know that for all its vaunted rhetoric about justice, American culture is incredibly ruthless. Look what happens if you get sick and you don't have proper insurance. You're bankrupted. So there is that horror, I think, of people, in people, of not being part of the herd, and that makes them slaves to the herd mentality, and it's a disaster.
Speak about the constructive role that hopelessness grief and loss can play in turning people around to embrace the larger scope of life on the planet and more passionately. We usually brush aside these emotions quickly, deny them, and then prefer to bury them in the shadow and out of sight. And we can say that both our individual and our collective shadows are largely responsible for the continuation of denialism.
Right.
We see all around us. So from the understanding of deep psychology, how might these otherwise negative emotions be utilized constructively to fuel more concerted activism for people to take more control over their lives?
Well, when you truly allow yourself to feel what I believe everybody is feeling unconsciously, the radical heartbreak of seeing the environment devastated, animals destroyed, billions living in terrible poverty, and, of course, the spiritual poverty of a culture that's dedicated to greed. If you allow yourself to feel that heartbreak, it's extremely painful, and it will devastate any fantasy that you have about your life or the future of humanity. But what it will bring you into connection with is true love, true compassion. And if you allow that connection to grow, you'll find that in the middle of that heartbreak, there is a fountain, and that fountain is gushing with wild, fierce compassion energy. And if you can connect with that wild, fierce compassion energy, then instead of just being apathetic or passive at what's unfolding or destroyed by pain and suffering, you can become a sacred activist, a love warrior for the new, and join with others and create bands of people who are not going to allow the human race to go into the dark without really trying to do something to turn it around. Not only are loss and fear and heartbreak not finally destructive, I would say that in a time like this, when the whole future of humanity is threatened, actually allowing ourselves to feel the loss of the habitats, the loss of the past's values, the loss of decency, the loss of truth, actually allowing ourselves to feel the heartbreak at the rule of the destructive and the dark on almost everything is our only hope for staying human, and more importantly, can lead, and has led in my case and in your case, to devoting our whole lives to being radicals for transformation.
Final question. We only have 2 minutes to go. When you look at the people running for office, you look at the state, local mayors, city council members, governors, senators, legislators, clear up to the president, what you see more often than not are narcissists. Some are sociopath.
Yes.
Many are overcompensating.
Yes.
Many are doing this to prove to someone that they're a somebody. You're seeing a lot of acting out, and yet we seem extremely reluctant to ever look for people who have true spiritual values, who would not be compromised, who would always look for universal truths, who would resolve conflicts using peace and understanding, and yet we reject these very people. Why?
Well, I think everything you say is true, and I think we've really analyzed the reasons, but don't you think there's something at least half optimistic about the reaction to Bernie Sanders? Here is this white-haired curmudgeon telling some pretty fierce truths and getting some pretty strong and positive reactions. He is a new kind of force in American politics, don't you think?
Yes, if he does not do this simply to, at one point, be the good corporate Democrat,
right, right,
and turn over his entire movement to Hillary Clinton. That's what Chris Hedges believes. That's what many people believe. I don't know that he would do that, but Bernie Sanders is right on when it comes to the banking community,
yes,
student education,
absolutely,
universal health care, against GMOs and labeling of food. He is absolutely correct on that. But he is also a militarist. He supports our engagement in
guns,
Yemen,
yeah,
and in Saudi Arabia. He even believes that Saudi Arabia should have more power, and yet they're a problem. So the point will come where we'll know whether or not Bernie Sanders was simply the Pied Piper to Hillary Clinton when we reach the convention or before, where he does not have enough of the delegates, will he take it to the convention floor, or will he simply say, I promised all along I would support the Democratic nominee, and so I want my people to support it, in which case he will betray that following, in which case you can bet that that probably it will be Donald Trump will become elected.
That's
because a lot of people are too idealistic and are going with him because he is idealistic. He is the for the only generation I'm aware of, they look at him as the wise man, the wise sage, the younger people.
And the fierce curmudgeon. I love that about him.
Yes.
That he's not playing sweet. He's not flattering anybody. He's a rough, tumble, no-nonsense, in-your-face curmudgeon. And that's fabulous, I think.
I agree. Well, let us hope that along the way, the generation that is out there now that has the capacity to change begins to solidify and keeps going in a positive way.
Absolutely.
Andrew, thank you for being on. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. I love you, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Andrew Harvey, and Andrew's book is The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, as well as Play Life More, Beautifully, Conversations with Seymour. His website is andrewharvey.net, and I'm Gary Nall. This has been A Conversation with Remarkable Minds. Thank you all for listening.